I was quite interested in this condition between inequality and stability. I was wondering what you thought about this paper from Lisa, I think it's Atkinson and Morelli, where they look at a couple hundred episodes of growing inequality and to see whether that was associated with financial crises. And they concluded that for these large number of cases going back to the 20th century throughout the world, that there was no general association between growing inequality and financial crises, and that may have been the case in the last crisis. I just wanted to hear what you were saying after that. I would think you'd use on that. Thanks.
Okay.
Sanga?
Thank you very much for excellent good presentation. I have a bit of from the inside to elaborate the very interesting trying to create the relationship between inequality and unemployment, and also the contribution of the finance sector to the growing inequality. My question is basically like this. It is easy to assumes actually financialization somehow contributes to increasing the incomes for the top income levels. That is not a difficult issue. But I just wonder if that also creates the extra pressure or the new pressure on the workers at the bottom income desk, for example.
I'm sorry, could you do that one more time? I have a hearing issue.
In my terminology, we can expect the phenomena. I can easily expect some kind of the flying top the phenomena associated with the financialization, you know, their income is flying. But I just wonder that also somehow induced the phenomena, what we call the collapsing bottom. So how that affects the low income earners, basically. So
right.
Because I found the empirical finding, the relationship between inequality and unemployment is very important. Because somehow I just suspect financialization creates some kind of pressure on the labor market, putting pressure on the low income, so creating probably in the typical radical economic terms, creating some of the reserve army of the unemployed or something, and somehow that creates extra pressure on those people, and so basically bottom is collapsing. So I just wonder if you have found such phenomena or any empirical evidence on this.
Got it. Okay.
Yes, and could you please introduce yourself?
From Baghdad. I was wondering if the observed increase in inequality, if that's driven by an increase at the top, or by a hollowing out of the middle of the income scale, and relatedly, if you observe such a hollowing out at the middle and the extent to which it's related to unemployment, if it's related to outsourcing.
Any other questions?
That's a challenging list of questions. Okay. The first one related to an article that examines the relationship between changes in inequality and financial crises going back. How far back do they go in that? To the 20s?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Back about 100 years.
Okay. I guess I have two observations about that. One is it's very hard to tell what the measurement's reliability actually is over an ambitious long period study of that kind. So I'm agnostic about findings of anybody's measures except mine. And not because I'm skeptical about them, but because I know what's in my measures, and I don't know, by and large, what's in other people's. I do know that in the survey literature, survey-based literature, many measures are of different kinds. Some countries measure income inequality, some measure expenditure inequality, South Asia particularly. Sometimes it's household, sometimes it's individual, sometimes it's gross of tax, sometimes it's net of tax. All of those things are actually classified in the data, and they all make a difference. So one of the things that we did with when we computed our estimated household income inequality series, which I didn't talk about here, was to adjust for all of that. And I think that's, again, a useful step. But then we're limited to going back to the 60s. Okay. So that's the first point is, I think economists, one burden that is on economists working in this field is to be very clear about their data and not to present data and just give a source and expect people to read it at face value. And particularly if you're finding a non-effect, there's a very serious risk that it's associated with the noise relative to signal in the data set. Second point, though, even allowing that the data were perfect, was not my purpose here to establish a 100% universal historical relationship. Clarity with which the movement of inequality in the income statistics of the United States is associated with very unstable financial market phenomena in the last 15 years is very plain. Right? I think it's a very compelling case. If one goes back, even in the US, to the period before 1980, that relationship isn't there. And I'm not trying to make a universal statement of an equilibrium condition. I'm trying to make a historical analysis of the modern case. And I think that's an important thing because it tells you the modern case is not the only case, and if you wanted a different case, you could perhaps construct it. You're not constrained by universal laws. So that's that would be perhaps a difference between my approach and the one described in the article you mentioned. Okay, second question about inequality and unemployment, and in particular, what do we observe about the effect of crisis and so on the bottom part of the wage distribution. Most of the work, in fact, all of the work that we do with inequality and unemployment is based upon structures of pay, so this complicating factor of capital market income isn't there in the data. So we are looking at, and there's the data will lend, therefore, more weight to the distributions, to the change in pay structures. And what one finds, I think, essentially, is a close relationship with probably two-way causality, in the sense that when unemployment goes up, the wage structure broadens. But also, if the wage structure has been compressed, there is a tendency over time for unemployment to stay relatively low compared to places where the wage structure is not compressed. Why is this the case theoretically? Let's consider whether you're looking at an area like Andalusia or a country, perhaps like China, where you have a small number of high-paid jobs and a very much larger number of very low-paid jobs. What's the incentive that people have? It's to leave the low-paid jobs and take their chances on getting one of the better ones, right? And so very high levels of inequality impart a strong incentive to migrate and to search, because it's the migrant who is likely to get the job, particularly a low-skilled job. People do not hunt for those on the internet while farming in the remote areas. They show up at the plant door, at the construction site, and apply. And so the expectation would be that high levels of inequality are associated with high levels of labor market movement at the bottom. And people then take the jobs that they can get for the time that they can get them and send part of their earnings back home. And of course, this is entirely consistent in Europe, in the United States, and in the measurements we have for China. I have a student working on migration patterns in China, where the floating population is, 140 million, something of that nature. So seems to me that once one sees the problem clearly in these terms, that inequality should be associated with unemployment is no surprise at all. Theoretically, entirely plausible. It's surprising that the contrary view, which was entirely from the employer's perspective and presupposes all kinds of careful matching of workers' skills to their job rates, it's a preposterous idea when nobody has this experience in the real world. Practically nobody. Economics professors maybe, but that it should be considered the dominant position in the study of labor markets. Okay. Is the inequality driven at the top or the middle? What's the effect of outsourcing? Again, to some degree, it depends upon what you're measuring. If one is measuring income inequality from tax records in the United States, as I showed, it's clearly driven from the top. And in fact, what happens at the top runs contrary to what happens in the middle. Because when you have the financial boom, things are good. There's prosperity. There's full employment. Wages are rising at the bottom. Poverty rates were falling. In the late 1990s, this was a prosperous period. So it's very important to understand that what's happening in the capital markets in a credit-driven economy is a major driver of what's happening to employment. The problem is not that it produces bad results while it's going on. The problem is that it doesn't last and cannot last. And that's why I say the issue here is instability. For most of our measures, we are not measuring capital market incomes. We're measuring pay structures. And so we're actually looking at matters which are much more closely associated with where rising inequality occurs as a result of higher unemployment and declining performance. And one has to keep that distinction in mind. And it's sometimes hard, but the fact is the world consists of different people who earn their income from different sources, and their incomes are going to be influenced depending upon whether they're in different ways, depending upon whether they're primarily capital income earners or primarily labor income earners. Outsourcing. Less there than meets the eye, in my view. Because it's primarily a phenomenon of the manufacturing sector, and labor in the advanced countries is primarily a phenomenon of the services sector. So I would say outsourcing fundamentally less important than many people make it out to be, and minimum wages much more so. Minimum wages and the coverage of labor contracts in the services sector, deeply important phenomena. And you discover that countries which have progressively raised their minimum wages, this shows up very clearly in compressing wage structures, improving outcomes.
Any other questions?
From Policy Innovation Department. The question concerning the relation inequality and instability, because a lot has been said about the U.S. economy relating to the crisis, to the housing market bubble and financialization rates. And in such a kind of case, how is it possible to extend this relation, the linkages, to other countries? Because one idea is that the global crisis has its linkages through the global imbalances and so on, income distribution played a role. But how is it possible to have models for other countries that are not the US?
Thank you. The extension of the influence of American policy to the rest of the world, it seems to me, is straightforward, and all of us have lived through it. Much of the rest of the world took out loans from Western banks. And in the 1980s, when those loans became unpayable, they went into a deep crisis. This was a global phenomenon with direct and easily measured effects on inequality outcomes. And it's very clear to all of us that this is the case. We all know it to be the case. It shows up in the data once you have a systematic record. Where it doesn't show up is in the economic literature on inequality, which prattles on about skill bias, technological change, the diffusion of computers, the role of education, And these asymmetric trade arguments. Some countries are getting rich while other ones are getting impoverished. Right? Ignoring the financial elephant in the room to a very substantial extent. That's where a large part of my energy is directed. This is pointing out that this has been the case and that it is still possible. Day before yesterday in Berlin, I heard James Heckman go on, he's a Nobel Prize winner, go on at great length about skills and inequality outcomes. And I don't think Mr. Heckman will ever pay attention to a line that reflects the contrary argument, nor will he bring into his analysis a single item of data that doesn't originate in some survey taken in the United States. Right? It's simply the rest of the world knows that financial decisions taken in Washington and New York and London matter for the rest of the world unless they have carefully insulated themselves with capital controls, as is the case in China and it's been the case in India and a handful of other places. That's my answer. This is a global phenomenon. And the capacity of individual governments in smaller countries to resist it is deeply limited. Big countries, okay. Big countries have the ability to set their own course. Small countries are dealing with powerful external actors who can reward them and punish them for non-compliance with a particular policy regime. They get immediate short-term advantages by being compliant and having access to credit flows, and they pay the price afterwards. So there again is something we all know, we've all experienced. It's a part of our the political economy that we've all lived through.
Patrick.
I have some information based upon, and there are some working papers in the series which look specifically at the course of minimum wages and show that, particularly when they've been raised, that you can see the effect in the tile statistic. There is literature also not originated by me for the US case that I'm familiar with. The name John DiNardo comes to mind, and the other authors will shortly re-enter main memory, showing the effect of minimum wages on wage structures in the US and particularly for women workers. And it's very clear that as the minimum wage eroded, the shelf disappeared and the effect became basically de minimis. So there is some direct evidence. My own work it is a little bit difficult to isolate a particular social policy and its consequence on inequality. And here's the reason. Consistent data is available only for a small number of countries, whereas we have inequality observations for a vast number. And so we haven't pursued that too much because it would involve cutting down the scale of the comparisons dramatically. And so, you know, it's there and people can do it if they want to, but it's not something that we have taken a lot of time with. Also because there is a lot of, common consequences. A country which has a strong labor movement is going to have a compressed wage structure, a high minimum wage, and a a good social insurance system, all these things come together. So isolating the effect of a particular measure statistically is, again, a little bit tricky. So all I can say is I've seen enough on that to be persuaded that it is a significant force. And clearly, that's clearly confirmed for the U.S. case by the work of other people that I know of.
Okay. One last question for me,
mm-hmm.
and then we'll close. Given the importance that you give in the book to the role of finance mm-hmm. in causing inequality, to what extent can labor market institutions mitigate inequality if there isn't financial reform?
In strong countries, labor market institutions have held. So if you look at, again, at North Europe, there are countries where inequality did not increase and where labor market outcomes remained reasonably good, at least up until relatively recently. Very much harder for countries which are financially vulnerable. Right? So the implication is that financial stabilization and control of financial instability has to be part of the policy mix. Right? I'm very much in favor of the efforts to integrate financial regulation in Latin America. The Andean initiative, for example, seems to me to be well worth pursuing. I'm very much in favor of the what's happened in Latin America, which has been a diversification of markets, so that they've benefited from the strong growth of the Chinese market in the last decade. That has helped stabilize things. I'm very much in favor of the fact that Latin American countries have ceased dealing with the IMF and have basically declared an intellectual independence from it. And that, again, is going to, I think, that serves them well. It's obvious that certain other countries have maintained their financial independence all along. And they are therefore able to pursue autonomous policies. And I'll just close by telling a little story. And you mentioned that I did some consulting work through the UNDP with the State Planning Commission in Beijing for 4 years. And in 1995, they asked if I would organize a meeting on international economic policy, basically monetary policy, which we did it for 3 days at Huairu outside Beijing. I'd been hearing things, so I needed a heavy artillery. And I called up Robert Eisner, former president of the American Economic Association and a very powerful intellect, distinguished guy. And I said, Bob, ever been to China? He said, no. I said, so here's the deal, like business class ticket, and I'll give you the UN per diem. Huh? He said, sounds good to me. I said, but there's a catch. He said, what's the catch? I said, you must talk them out of liberalizing the capital account. He said, okay. So Bob went to China and did his best to persuade them that liberalizing the capital account would not have been a good idea, and they didn't do it. Now, whether they were really going to do it otherwise, I'm not sure. You never know. But I take credit for having protected the People's Republic from the 1997 Asian crisis. And thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.